I ran out of notes.
I didn't take any, so I also ran out of notes.
Hello, and welcome to Snark Squad Pod, a media podcast full of friendship, feelings, and snark. My name is Marines.
I'm Nicole Sweeney.
And today we are joined by Samantha Lane.
Hi guys, I'm Sam, and I talk about books and other media online on my YouTube channel, Thoughts on Tomes, and I also gush on other socials, which are also Thoughts on Tomes.
And Sam is here today to talk to us about The Night Circus, which is a 2011 fantasy novel written by Aaron Morgenstern. It is a nonlinear story that follows a few different characters, a lot of different characters actually, who are all connected in some way or another with a magical circus, which, as the name suggests, only appears at night. I'm not going to touch on all of the many characters in this plot synopsis, but at the beginning of the story, two old magicians with very different philosophies on magic make a wager in which they pit two students against each other. Hector Bowen, one of these two magicians, his student is his newly discovered six-year-old daughter, Celia, who has a natural gift for object manipulation. His opponent, Alexander, finds his student, Marco, in an orphanage. The two are kept apart and not really told anything about the game except for the fact that there is going to be a game and that, I don't know, man, it'll start someday and the rules are, I don't know. And they're sort of magically bound to this game. A little over a decade after the wager is made, the game begins with the development of this fantastical circus. And generally speaking, most of the people that are involved in the circus think that it is like a normal circus. They don't realize that actual magic is happening. Over the course of the next decade and a half, Celia and Marco manipulate the circus. And that is like basically the game sort of playing out. As all of this is happening, the two slowly fall in love with each other. And near the end of the book, they realize that the game only ends when one of them is dead. And
it sucks.
Since they are in love with each other, this is obviously terrible. Through magic, they bind themselves to the circus. So the game sort of ends up in a stalemate, and the circus is ultimately taken over by some of the other people who have been kind of sucked into the world of the circus. And that's the plot.
This is one of those weeks where I know the answer to our very first question by virtue of this being like an older release that we are revisiting. But for the sake of starting where we always start and for the people listening at home, Sam, did you like this?
So the reason I'm here is because this is my favorite book of all time. So yes, I liked it. This is one of the few books that I've reread. I've talked about when I've been on a guest here before that I'm not a big rereader, and it's where Mari and I really differ. And I've read this, I think, 3 times, which is like a record for me, actually.
I always love when people who aren't re-consumers of things talk about their like 1 or 2 big re-consumptions, and it's like some number I can 3. Count on my hand.
I mean, that's really the commitment for me, right? Like 3 times in different forms, even like what? So yeah, so this is one of my favorite, I mean, it is my favorite story, my favorite book. And every time I read it, it's one of those books that I come back to and I see a new thing every time. And I love how layered and complex it is. So it's everything to me.
I also thoroughly enjoyed this book. I read this book originally at some point in the first year after it was published because it was making the rounds through the friend group that Mari and I sort of originally met in, and I actually borrowed it from one of our friends in that sort of little circle. My Goodreads review is non-existent. I just gave it a star rating and that's it. But the book lives very, very strongly in my feelings, mostly because of the circus itself. Like I just have a very, very strong impression, have carried with me for the last, nearly a decade, a very strong impression of how much I loved the world of this book. And so rereading it for the podcast was really, really interesting because I remembered a lot, but also I didn't remember exactly how it ended. So it was kind of a fun experience in terms of a reread. But in general, yes, I thoroughly loved this book.
That prompted me to look up when I originally read this, and it was apparently within 2 months of this being published in 2011, which is really shocking to me because I'm not somebody who reads things pretty soon after they are published. But
right, same. But we were talking about it in our little group, in our email chain.
I don't remember this at all. Okay, we read this together in 2011. And I enjoyed it then. I gave it 4 stars, and I very distinctly remember the problems that I had with it. But I reread it in 2016, also with friends, a different group of friends. And I was like, oh, Past Me is wrong. I actually love this. So it is one of those books that improved in my feelings because of rereading. And also because of knowing the end. I think that in knowing the end, I was kind of less focused on what I thought was the plot the first time around, which was like Celia and Marco and kind of their relationship. But I don't know, second time around, I was really there for the circus. And then, so this is the third time that I've reread it. And yes, I love this book. And I'm excited to talk to you guys about it today. And starting with the most important character, the circus.
Yes,
you mentioned like it lives very strongly in your feelings, but I think that it is the standout of the story by far.
Yeah, I think about the tents of the circus like frequently. Like I'll just be sitting there randomly, you know, minding my own business, and I'll think about like the cloud tent or the smell tent or even the ones that are like a little. Like, there's definitely ones that are eerie feeling and stuff. And I just want to be there so desperately. Mm-hmm. Yes. Like, it is one of those places that very rarely do I want to visit fantasy worlds. I'm like, no, please don't. I would die. It's very scary. I don't want to go. But with this, I'm like, please be real. I just really would rather just live there and be with the circus and be happy in this magical place. So it's one of the few places that's fantastical that I actually want to go to as desperately as most people probably want to go to Hogwarts.
Yeah, this is clearly the best fantasy world from a book to go to. If I could go to anywhere in a book, I feel like I would be hard pressed to find somewhere that appeals to me more than this circus. I'm not somebody who pictures things very vividly when I'm reading. I don't know, my experience of reading is very word based and like feeling based. I don't know, it's hard for me to articulate why I am so impressed with this book, but it is related to that. Like, it's related to the fact that I don't typically like see a lot. I have almost never seen a casting announcement and been like, that's not at all how I pictured that person. I never picture an actual person. Like, I picture like a weird, I don't know, like there's like a phantasm. I pictured the feelings, like I'm feeling things, but there's not really like a person there. And so but this is a book where I can picture a ton of things, definitely not people, but there are things like I can see the circus in my head. I also like can feel it so clearly. And I don't know, the atmosphere that Erin Morgenstern creates in this book is just so palpable and magical.
Yeah, I'm the very same way with what you were saying about not picturing characters. Like, I really don't either. And I've talked about that before on my platforms and stuff. And with this, I'm the same way that if they're supposed to be adapting this, blah, 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 that they always say that. And my concern is not the casting, it's the aesthetic. Like, you have to get it right, and it has to be the right kind of director, and it has to look the way that I'm picturing it looking, because if it doesn't, I'm going to be devastated. The cast, I really don't care about. Like, I could anybody really, anyone that you think will work, they'll work fine, but it really, the circus has to look a certain way. So I completely agree with what you're saying.
I understand that sort of reaction, and I agree with the spirit of that, in that the circus is for sure the most important part of adapting this. That's why we're talking about the circus before any of the characters. So like, obviously adaptation has to get the fucking circus right. But to me, I am not really nervous about it so much as I am excited about the idea of seeing what someone else sees. Like, because the experience is so magical, it just seems so cool to think that I could get to, I don't know, witness on screen what somebody else is seeing when they're reading this, if that makes any sense. I don't know. I'm excited. I'm very optimistic, I guess.
I wish I could live in your head. Because I am fear. I think because ever since I read this, I always pictured this sort of as like a Baz Luhrmann movie. He did like Moulin Rouge and The Great Gatsby. And like those that kind of fantastical colors, all of that. He's just a very aesthetic director. So I've always kind of pictured that look. And I feel like if I don't get that look, I'll be sad. And that's not fair because he's not going to direct it. So I'm kind
but
of screwed.
Truly, he would be the best choice. You're not wrong.
I am correct.
I think that it's interesting to me because this is like a very evocative setting. And part of the way that Erin Morgenstern does it is that it's very descriptive. And I think that people maybe that have trouble with this probably have trouble with the descriptions and like how heavy it is. There are entire chapters and scenes where it's just like, we're going to walk around the circus now. And I'm like, yes, I love it. But I can see other people like not enjoying that and wanting to get, I guess, to a meatier plot or whatnot. But I think part of the way that Erin does it is that it's like sights, smells, colors, all of these things are like baked into the descriptions. And there are things like a circus is just very vibrant anyway. But then she starts pulling all of these like, I don't know, very strong scents and emotions associated with it that I think of this book and I like smell popcorn and hear crowd. Like it's a strange experience and it's not one that I think I've ever had with any other book. And it's especially impressive because this is a fantasy book and it's not an experience I've ever had necessarily, but she puts it out there so well that it's like attached in my brain that way.
I think that's a really good point too about all of the emotional affect that she attaches to these descriptions, because hearing you say that, I'm like, oh, normally I am that person. That is totally a description of things I do not enjoy. Whole chapters where there aren't really any characters, where you're just like looking at the world. I hate that shit. But it works for me here. And I think it is the degree to which all of that is also emotional. Like, it's not just look at the circus, it's like feel the circus.
I think she does a good job of it too, because, well, one, there's like multiple layers to this story and sort of multiple timelines. I mean, it's always a circus, but you know, we're seeing characters in sort of different parts of the circus's story. But then you also had those chapters where it's like you're doing this in the circus. So it's like you are literally like feeling like you're in the circus, and that second person narrative like very rarely works for me and usually jars me and I don't like it. And in this, it places you literally in the story with everybody and in this circus. And I think that's what kind of makes it such like a more emotional, visceral experience than if you were just told what the characters were doing in the circus.
She also does two other things that are sometimes red flags for me, things that often jump out at me as things that I don't enjoy in stories: the nonlinear storytelling and the fact that there isn't really like a single protagonist. But again, I think both of those things are deployed so effectively. The nonlinear storytelling works really well for the circus specifically. Like it feels appropriate for the circus, and having multiple characters that we're focusing on allows the circus to remain the number one. You're the most important character in the book.
I also like enjoy that for me, the circus, which is probably one of the most magical elements of the book, feels so concrete. But in general, the atmosphere of this book is very dreamlike. And I think that she achieves that because of like the jumping around in the time and because she places us in the circus or whatnot. And so like those two competing things where I can imagine the circus so clearly in my head, but also as you're reading it, it is like so whimsical and dreamlike, works for me. And I think that because those tools that maybe sometimes in other hands and other stories don't work there, the fact that they add to the atmosphere here is what kept me like completely invested. The first time that I read the book, one of my main complaints was about the characters and kind of that dreamlike aspect of it, and feeling like I didn't really know the characters. I wasn't fully invested. And then I understood that the circus was a character, and we were like learning a lot about the other people through the circus. And specifically, I think Celia and Marco, like you learn a lot about them because they're the ones like in control. But how did you feel about them as characters?
Well, Celia and Marco are like my children. I instantly loved them. So I have grown, and I like a lot of the side characters as well. I mean, like we've said, there's not really like main protagonists, although Celia and Marco, I guess, are supposed to be our main protagonists along with the circus. But I was very instantly drawn to their story, I think because you know that you're going to get some kind of like romantic element to it. And they literally have like magical wedding rings on without knowing each other. And I'm like, okay, super invested in this like star-crossed lover bullshit. Cool. So I was instantly just really drawn to them. And I just actually really like both of them. And just their arcs and stuff and how different they are in the whole like opposing ways of learning magic and everything. So I was really invested in their story, at least. I mean, I'm always invested, but especially the first time that I read it. And then I grew to love some of the other plot points more, because originally I didn't quite care as much about like the kids in the more recent, I guess you could say, timeline and what was going on with them. I was like, let's just get back to Celia and Marco in the circus. And now I care about all of it because I do know how it's all so interconnected. But at the beginning, when I first read it, I only really was wanting to get back to them and their, you know, doomed relationship. I loved it.
Yeah, I think the Bailey stuff in particular is the point where I could most see it, you know, starting to lose people, like the early Bailey chapters mm-hmm. being sort of a weird, like, why have we left the circus? I want to go back. but again, knowing how it all fits together, it's hard not to appreciate that too. I also really, I care a lot about Celia and Marco. Celia more than Marco. I'm going to be real.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, we meet Celia first. So that's obviously a big piece of it. But also, both of their backstories are incredibly tragic in very different ways. But Celia's hits me harder. Mm-hmm. And so, and like, you know, the fact that we are watching the way that her father is abusing her in those early chapters. I don't know, man. I just care so much about this girl and I just want her to be happy. I also care very, very deeply about this relationship. And on this reread, not really remembering how it ended, I also found myself kind of like frustrated with the presence of Isabel and then sort of coming around the way that Isabel's story sort of ends. I came to appreciate it more, but I was like, I don't want an obstacle. Like, I don't want an additional obstacle. The circus or the game is the obstacle already. Like, we don't need this additional obstacle for these beautiful star-crossed lovers.
The thing that struck me the most, I think, this reread is that when reading their backstory and kind of understanding the game that they're locked into, like, that should not produce the characters that we necessarily have. And I just appreciated how they're both, like, genuinely good people. And mm-hmm. they yeah. also, they're competing against each other, but it's never nasty. Like, even when they don't know who the other is, they're competing in a way that never felt like they were attacking each other. And it just is so precious and wonderful. I've seen like negative reviews of this call it very insta-lovey, but I don't know if that feels right to me. And if it is insta-love, it's one that I kind of understand. They're literally magically bound to each other. Yes. So like, that's kind of the point.
Also part of the point, and we see this as well with, I'm forgetting her name now, but the contortionist.
Tsukiko.
Yes. Who is a former student of Alexander's and like the winner of the previous game or whatever. And she also kind of alludes to this, but like part of what you're seeing here is that the game itself is set up by two people who are not participating in it. And so whatever their investment is in beating the other person, part of what you see is that, you know, conscripting new players doesn't actually bestow upon them the like the passions that drive you to want to defeat the other person. Like there's no bad blood in this for either of them, for each other. Like all of the enmity that they feel is for their instructors for forcing them into this situation in the first place. They have no reason to feel any sort of contempt for each other. It is by no means like the sort of prevailing thing that I take away from this story, but certainly this idea of not having those enmities passed on through generations, I think is definitely a big part of what is going on in this story.
Yeah, I also love that when Tsukiko, you know, comes up and she tells finally kind of that she was a past contestant, she kind of says, like, this is what always happens. Like, these, you always, all the contestants sort of fall in love with one another. I don't know if she says that directly or if it's just implied, but she's like, that happened with me. It happens with everybody. Like, just the nature of how they set this up to be something where it almost is a, it's always sort of a collaborative event. You know, I know when I first heard about this book, I was like, oh, it's this competition. It's very like Hunger Games-y or something. And it's like, oh no, this is a more quiet, like art based competition in which there's a lot of collaboration, regardless of who the contestants are, even in the past, it sounds like. So making it like that, I think is really interesting for our two sort of biggest antagonists as the teachers. I don't even really call them villains, because I think a lot of the things they do, aside from, you know, the child abuse, is not particularly villainous. It's just like thoughtless. Like, they just don't realize, like, they sort of, they're so like old and in this and have sort of like lost the connection to their own like feelings that they don't really even realize what they're doing. Not that it's forgivable, but it makes them less like mustache twirling villains trying to ruin people's lives and just like sort of doing something dumb over a bet that's meaningless really to them and just kind of like fun and games. And then these, all these people's lives get overturned because of it.
See, but that, like, that is villainous, right? Like, they are, I don't know, they are villains. I agree with everything you are saying, except for that.
Non-malicious villains, which is why I call them, like, antagonists, because they are antagonistic, but, like, I don't see them as the same kind of villains as, like, the Capitol and the Hunger Games. You know, like, they're doing bad things, and I would still say they're bad people, but, like, it feels like a different, like I said, more of an antagonistic relationship than a flat-out, like, they're trying to do all of these bad things. It still makes them bad, but villain feels like too strong.
It also seems like part of the point of the story, though, is that not caring how their actions affect other people is like, that is bad. Like, that is, yes, evil. And that is part of what, you know, leads Celia to her breaking point. That is why Celia wants out. One of, you know, many reasons that Celia wants, mm-hmm, out, but a big thing that drives her is a handful of interactions that she has late in the book where she's seeing how much this game is affecting other people and how terrible it is that this game is affecting other people. And, you know, the only reason that when she wants out, she doesn't just, you know, kill herself immediately, basically, is that she wants to make sure that all of the other people who have been swept up in this are protected. And I don't know, like, it seems like very much the point of the book that kind of ambivalence about how what you are doing affects other people is like blatantly morally very bad.
Yeah, totally. I get what you're saying. I guess I just like these kinds of villains. I think we all talked about like our just general dislike of like the mustache twirling villain of like,
right,
they're so villainous because they're this and this and blah, blah, blah. And I kind of find these like not vagueness, because obviously we know that the things that they're doing are causing harm, but just like the fact that they're not really actively doing anything, like their lack of like doing much of anything, I think is what really fascinates me about these particular antagonists, that makes me kind of not like them, but that I just like this kind of dynamic where it's like they're not like, the main characters aren't really fighting these villains. They're fighting the situations that the antagonist's lack of caring put them into, which is different than what you typically end up seeing in like a big fantasy where it's like usually there's this like evil dark lord that you're trying to, you know, get rid of. It's not really that same situation. And the villains are kind of going to go on and continue on in their, you know, betting and stuff like that. So I think it's just a different way of approaching more of a fantasy setting than what we typically see.
Similar to what Nicole was saying, I think that like kind of one of the things that the book wants you to think about is like the price of magic. I was really struck by how dark I felt this book was this time around, because when I walk away from it, the prevailing feeling is always like, ooh, circus. And we even started this by saying like, I would go there. But also like, this is like built on like the pain in the backs of two people who had no choice in the matter. Mm-hmm. And like that like sadness really stuck out to me. So I think one of the things that the book asks you to take a look at is kind of like the price of magic. And these are two men who have been alive for so long and dealing in magic for so long that I think they don't feel like people anymore. They've lost a lot of their humanity. And I think that that's why they can use other people as tools to continue this stupid game that they've been playing for so long. So I see, like, you know, where you feel like they're not traditional villains and that kind of disconnect. But yeah, they're super bad people.
Oh, for sure. For sure.
Ironically, given how fantastical this story is, I think that all of that is part of what grounds the story and makes it all feel very real, or makes the sort of plot elements of it feel incredibly real, is that it's not. But the reason that I hate the sort of mustache twirling villain is that does not feel real to me. Like, mm-hmm. people who are doing harm, it's not usually that they're like, man, I really want to hurt people. Like, yes, that exists, but it's usually more in the vein of what we're seeing here, where they're doing things that hurt other people. And like, that's incidental to what they're doing and they don't really care.
Yeah, I think as far as you were kind of touched on the fact that this is a fantasy story, but it also really feels just very human in a lot of ways that I feel like some other fantasies don't. I think so many of the side characters really add to that too. And every time I read this, I fall more in love with that group of people that created the circus. And I get so emotional over them and like all of the ways that they're alive. Like, they were pulled into something that they had literally no idea. And like, yes, Celia and Marco didn't know either, but they knew they had magical wedding bands on. Like, they knew something was coming, you know, like they're at least semi-prepared. Like, these other people had no clue. And so to have all the things that happen with them and sort of like their little snippets of their lives that we get and like their relationships with each other and everything, like, I just love that because they always feel like they have lives outside of just the circus and before we see them, where I feel like sometimes with more minor side characters and other stories, you don't get that. You kind of feel like they're just there for the plot or to, you know, propel something along. And I really always feel like these side characters have fully fleshed out lives, even if I'm not seeing everything that they're doing.
I maintain that the one exception to that for me is Isabel. Like, I agree yes. with that otherwise. Even though I sort of came around to how she is ultimately used in the story, she is, I think, probably the weakest link in terms of additional characters, not like who she is as a person, but like in that who she is as a person is the least fully realized. Like, I feel that way. I can imagine sort of the full extent of nearly every other character in this book that we spend time with. But Isabel is like, falls in love with this guy and then immediately like that is the like the real insta love to me is the Isabel Marco dynamic.
Yeah, for sure.
So I've been really in my feels lately. Apparently the last thing we recorded was a Cooler Than Homework for the 13th year, in which I talked about having feelings for that as well. So putting into perspective that I've just been in my feelings lately, I found her story really tragic this time. The whole thing was super dark for me this time, but her story, I agree that she's not fully realized, but I think that it may be a product of like what Morgenstern was trying to do with her story, even if it didn't work out correctly. At one point, Celia addresses it with Marco, and she basically tells him that as much as I love our main characters and they're trying to do their best, I think that idea of like magic still affects the people around you is obviously there. And part of that is that Marco has this thing that I think she compares it to her own father, where he's making people around him fall in love, or mm-hmm. that he's manipulating mm-hmm. their emotions in order to use them. And we see that with Chandress, and we see it with Isabel too, is that they're wrapped up in Marco because almost by magic. And the fact that mm-hmm. she instantly is like, yes, I will help you and I will travel and I'm so connected to you. Like, it felt empty for a female character, I think, in the story. But I would assume that that's where the author was going with it, that this was a byproduct or another, like, you know,
another consequence of his magic. And he sort of talks about the way that he does it almost unthinkingly, that he's been doing it so long. And
right.
Yes, I accept that reading. I retract my prior comment.
As far as the other, like the core group of people that like set up the circus, I really love them too. There are a lot of like one other actually side character that I want to talk about. But as far as the people that set up the circus, I think that I love that we have this very limited number of magical people like within the story. And these people who set up the circus are just like not like magical also, but the kind of like magical, really good at what they do people that you could almost expect to run crossing your own life. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like, and I just always really love characters that are very highly skilled, because I am 100% not great at anything. I'm like a mile wide and an inch deep, right? And that, so I've always been like fascinated with people who are just amazing at what they do. So the fact that this group of characters were just like highly skilled people that came together and dreamt up so much of this, you know, the foundation of the circus, like, I love them. They're precious.
Yeah. And like you said, they're magicians in their own right, because people believed that this magical circus was based in reality because these people were so good at what they did that they were like, well, yeah, they could do that, you know, like, and that's just so cool. And just, I love the dinner parties and just their, you know, you feel so bad when they're lives start to fall apart, you know, when when you see them at the very beginning and they're all becoming friends, and then you see these things happening to them throughout, like these side characters that really are very, very minor parts in the story. I always feel like my heart being torn out when all these horrible things are happening to them, because I'm like, they used to be so happy and it was all so glamorous and now it's all going to hell. Like, I just get so, I get as invested in them as I do in like Celia and Marco's, you know, love story. So I just, those are characters too that I just do often think about, and just all of the setting that they're in and how they're just pulled in, like you guys have said, and magic is hurting them and they're not even aware that it's there.
And it's told with such a, I don't know, soft touch. Like, it's, it, there are very few, you know, details given for the, like, the tragedy. And I think that that is one way in which this book definitely rewards rereading, is that there's a lot that is just very, very subtle, but it's there. And I think that that is part of what makes it work so well, because like the reader is also getting the sort of glamorous veil of this world pulled over their eyes too. And so you're kind of slowly realizing how complicated this is for everybody involved. And, you know, what at first seemed really like simple and magical is actually, as Mari keeps saying, is actually really dark. And I would also add the midnight dinners to the list of like fantasy places that would be in my top 10 fantasy places to experience.
I mean, the fact that Aaron Morgenstern gave us a circus, which is pretty much one of the best settings in fiction ever, and then sprinkled the midnight dinners on top. Like, what even?
Wow.
We're talking about like the people who set up the circus in general, but just a little like side shout out to Tara Laney Burgess, because they gave me big time sister feels. Mm-hmm. And I think that, you know, one of the great things that Erin does in her writing, I think, is like she foreshadows a lot. And then every time that I asked myself a question, she answered it. So one of the things that I like was asking was why Tara was the one who was asking the questions and like kind of breaking out of the spell. And then, you know, chapters later, she addresses it very like head on about how Tara was the sister that saw the larger scope, right? And Lainey was so in the details that she never thought to ask the questions. And because Tara kind of had that vision, she was able to see that something bigger was going on. And all of the descriptions of their relationship about how they complemented each other and all of that, just again, sadness. but I thought that they were especially well done.
To the, you know, tremendous sister feels. It's one of those things that like you see in close relationships where you know, you grow up with someone, like you see the ways in which people do develop those kinds of complementary, you know, skills and abilities. And especially in this case where the two of them were, you know, in addition to like being family, they also work together in their adult lives. Yes, it was incredibly well done and felt incredibly real.
Yeah, like you guys were talking about earlier, how subtle Erin Morgenstern's writing can be in some ways. Obviously, she has this lush descriptive writing, but I think she does subtlety in relationships, whether they're familial or, you know, friendship or relationships, romantic, just she does that really well. And in a way that's so simple that even a few lines can give you that feeling of how close people are. And she doesn't have to just force it on you and keep showing you over and over. Like, she's just able to do it in very few lines. And she's one of the only authors I've really seen that has done that, because I've read her second book now too. And she does the same thing there. And I'm like, how do you do like two sentences? And now I know their whole life story. And I don't know how you did that and how you'd like were able to show me how much they care about one another. But now I know. And it's just, it's so beautiful. beautiful at how like layered all of the story is, whether it's the aesthetics of the circus or whether it's the different relationships and how every one of those midnight dinners, how they all interact with one another. And you kind of get that feeling of closeness while it's not touched on, you know, constantly. Like you get very few midnight dinners, but you feel like you were at every single one of them.
She balances too. I keep saying how dark this is, but she balances the romance of magic really well to a point where there is like some point in the story is like, is everybody just going to kiss? They're like all in love with each other almost. And it, but it's not necessarily romantic love, but it's like the romance of the magic coupled with like the closeness that they develop as like the traveling circus in the family, that I thought was like, you really felt the connections between the two of them. And that's purposeful, right? Because there is literally something binding them together. And the fact that you can feel those bounds or whatnot, I thought was, you know, again, just giving me all the feels.
I also just love how every piece of this story feels so integral to it, even if it's not clear to you while you're reading it, but like taking a step back and looking at the thing as a whole. All of these people are necessary to the story in some way or another, whether it's, you know, like plot reasons or just the way in which the different characters flesh each other out. Like I'm thinking about the twins, and in terms of the way that they serve the plot, the twins really could have been one kid and that, you know, would have advanced the plot just as well. But I think in terms of making them feel real, making them twins was like really, really useful. And I think it did a lot to explain, I don't know, just like why they were the way that they were, the fact that they had each other growing up in this, you know, fantastical setting.
The other side character that I want to give a not only a shout out to, but talk a little bit about, because in a lot of ways, I think that this story is a story that is about telling stories and, you know, creating things, you know. Whether here it's like a magical circus, but you could apply basically to any art, sort of the way that she approaches talking about creating things. And so I think that something that stuck out to me a lot this reread was the reverse as like fandom and the way that they talk about them being formed and how they came together. And at the heart of that is the clockmaker Thiessen, right? And he's also got like very, very integral to the circus and then the fandom that develops around the circus. But then also very tragic story kind of at the end. So I want to talk about him, but also kind of, I don't know, something about inserting a fandom for the circus as you're reading also made me love it more and think about the family that is not only forming like as integral as part of like making the circus, but the family that kind of develops around it as well.
Yeah, the whole like you feel like you're one of them, right? Like you feel like you're in the fandom now. Like I want to wear like the red, like all the, you know, like that's yes. Like I think we as readers, especially if you're a part of a fandom, you know, otherwise, you just get that. Like, of course there'd be a fandom. Why wouldn't there be? And I think the fact too, like I do follow Erin Morgenstern on Twitter, and she does a toast to Thiessen every year, which I think is so sweet and just shows how like integral he was. And it's almost like a toast to fans and like without saying that and all of that. So he's one of the characters too that just, yeah, feels so real and just loved this thing so much. And it made him so happy
And is such a huge part of, you know, a story about telling stories. Like, obviously, if you're going to tell stories, there is an audience for the telling of stories. And so to include that audience is really kind of cool and beautiful. I will say my other kind of like half. So Isabel was my one half, almost a critique, now retracted. This is an even smaller one. And that is the beginning of that final chapter where Bailey is talking to Alexander and they, I don't know, have their whole conversation, the meta conversation about stories. It's one of those things that I am generally trash for. Like, obviously, this podcast is a testament to my love of dissecting and thinking about stories and how important stories are. But it's also one of those things that also people who write stories, you know, love stories and think they're really cool. And so it's a thing that you see in media. And as a trope, it's something that I both am trash for and also can acknowledge the degree to which it's incredibly self-serving of an author to insert a treatise on how important it is to tell a story into their story. And so it was the only moment in this reread where I was briefly taken out of the story as they were having that sort of meta conversation. Like this, that's for me, my experience as a reader. It was the one point in the story and, you know, pretty good, got me basically to the end before this happened, but where I did have this moment where I like stopped and like stepped out of it to analyze how it was using this particular trope.
Okay. Okay. So I'm sitting over here just like trying not to laugh and geeking out. You said this happened on reread. Recently, the Game of Thrones final season happened, where the writers were like, stories, meh. Do you think that could have affected it?
I mean, sure. I don't deny the possibility of that. I think that it is a little bit more than that. Nothing in the story deals with that idea up to that point. Like, we're not grappling with that at any point prior to that chapter. And so I think that is part of why I still hold that it's a little bit of a, and now, I don't know, it still falls into a larger category of stories doing that thing in a way that I am not clear if it's necessary. It's definitely not a Game of Thrones level move. To be clear, I think that choice was fucking stupid, and I don't think that this was.
That tracks for me, for you, because I'm sitting here thinking about one of your favorite books of all time, which is The Amber Spyglass.
Yeah.
And like, it also ends on a huge, like, stories are important thing, but it is something that it has been building across all three books as Lyra is a known storyteller,
right,
and a known liar, and you know, like that whole right kind of thing culminates at the end. And I think that the message there is more like stories are important as they pertain to living your life kind of thing, as like, you know, you building your own personal story and living your life to the fullest, where here it was a little more like congratulations, pat on the backy. So like, there are degrees of difference. And, you know, even apart from this, like when actors or like, you know, if there's a TV show that is talking about like the writer's room or acting or Hollywood or whatever, it can either be like hilarious and a great nod, or like, okay guys, we get it, you love yourself. So it's not singular to the Night Circus, but I get why, you know, it works in some places and not others.
I do want to mention, and I know this was an accident, but I don't want it to actually be an accident. I want this to be like fate. We're recording this on the day that the Night Circus like premiered 133 years ago, if it was real.
Oh no, it wasn't on purpose. It wasn't on
purpose. I know that. Magical. I know that to be true. I know that to be true because I couldn't record on the date you guys wanted to record, but I like to think that my soul did that on purpose.
Right.
So we could record on the appropriate date.
Yes. So it was on purpose by you, subconsciously.
Subconsciously, yes.
We talked a little bit about the ending by way of like the whole storytelling message at the end, but otherwise, how did you feel about how it ended? Especially for Celia and Marco, kind of. So at the end, they were like, you know, part of the circus, trapped in the circus forever. Was that satisfying?
I love it just because I love like the tragedy almost of that, but also they seem to be happy in the circus, you know, like that's their love letter to one another, and now they're like in that, and they're in that because they did love each other so much and they wanted to save each other, and you know, that whole like tragedy of all that. So I love it because it's sort of bittersweet. I think it's more sweet than bitter, but I do love romantic endings a lot of times that are sort of bittersweet. And it kind of is perfect for the story of that, like, you know, magic is sort of very romantic, but also dangerous and sort of has like, you know, it's a double-edged sword. So I liked that. And I liked how the ending does bring it all together. You know, you finally see like why Bailey was like important through most of the story. You're like, why do we keep going back to him? What? So especially for rereads, it's just like, oh yes, because this is a giant web that's finally going to be brought together at the end. So, and I like how, you know, the circus didn't have to end, you know, it could still go on and not be the toxic thing that it was turning into.
Yeah, I am not somebody who likes the any bitterness. I want it to be happy. However, this is a story that, like, it really couldn't have ended in a way that was without any sort of bitterness. And so I agree in that it generally feels like appropriate for the story.
Either the circus was going to continue or Marco and Celia were going to, like, be alive, and you couldn't have both.
Right.
But this gave you a way that there kind of was both. So I was like, okay, I'll accept it.
I accept this offer.
I always flip-flop on Bailey as a character. I think first read I was like, no. And then second read I was like, okay. And this one I was like, I don't know. Like, I don't know about Bailey. And, like, I guess the whole point is that, like, he was important to the circus because he was, and I don't know.
He was important to the circus because he wanted to be, because he chose to be,
yes,
in a way that nobody else in the story did. Everybody else was in some way or another conscripted into it. Even the people who helped build it were not going into the larger thing with their eyes wide open. They were still, to some degree or another, conscripted into the circus. And Bailey is the first person who chose it. And like, that's the whole thing, is that he wasn't chosen. He did the choosing himself. And so, I don't know, that I loved that. I guess you can tell, you could probably tell by the force with which I jumped in.
Listen, this is like when I was like, listen, about Isabel.
Yeah. Let me tell you.
Maybe what I want is less scenes of Bailey in a tree.
That is fair.
That's a fair point. I will not try to argue that we needed any more scenes of Bailey in a tree. So while I was reading this, on this particular reread, I both read the Kindle book and also was listening to the audiobook, which was truly fantastic. We haven't mentioned how great the audiobook is, but that deserves a shout out.
Yes.
It's great. If you haven't read this book and you've listened to this whole podcast up to this point, I don't know why, but I highly recommend the audiobook as your way of reading this book. But on Kindle, I highlighted all of two quotes. One was about Bailey not being destined or chosen. So clearly I did indeed love that. But the other thing that I highlighted was also in relation to Bailey. This is random, but the Bailey's grandmother talking to Bailey about his parents. Like, there is so much backstory in this book that's all very, very subtle and very, very quick. But Bailey's grandma did not want his parents to get married, but, you know, she let them anyway because she knew that her daughter would do it anyway. So, you know, there was no point in trying to stop it. And now Bailey's dad is, you know, trying to force him to stay on this farm where he doesn't want to be and whatever. And his grandma says he forgets that he was someone's dream once himself. And I just find something really lovely and poignant and thoughtful about that. And I think it plays to this kind of larger conversation about how much Aaron Morgenstern does with the side characters. That, like, truly Bailey's grandmother is such a, like, throwaway and, like, irrelevant character. But also, like, I have a clear concept of who this woman is.
Yeah, I don't know many authors that pull it off as well as she does. Like I said, especially having read the second book by her, that it's not just like a one-time thing that she just magically happened to do because the Night Circus is perfect. But, like, she just does this. And it's like all of these characters feel like they're out in the world living their lives, not just here to, you know, say a one-off line to provide backstory. Like, they just feel, they feel loved. Like, I feel like she loves her characters. I know that all authors do, but just in a different way that just makes them come off the page in a way that is rare.
And even though this is a circus that I cannot attend and that is propped up by sadness and magic for most of the story, it is still, I don't know if this is going to make me sound like a bad person, but I would still go there.
Even though I know that it's propped up by sadness and misery, I would still love to go and be happy.
I want to eat all the things that are there and visit all the tents.
I mean, I know it's not the same, but ever since reading this book, I've planned my wedding and rehearsal dinner around the midnight dinners and the night circus. So you might get to go there if we're like,
I mean,
you know.
Obviously, though, right? Like, it is a really dope theme.
Right. It's really good. I have Pinterest boards, guys. I'm not even dating anybody.
I'm going to start napping from now to prepare for that midnight wedding. And on that note, thank you to Sam for joining us this week, and thank you all for listening. If you're enjoying this podcast, consider sharing it with your friends or rating and reviewing it wherever you are listening. We'd love to hear all of your thoughts on The Night Circus. There will be a post dedicated to this episode up on snarksquad.com. You can also sign up to join our community on Patreon at patreon.com/snarksquad. You can also find all of us on Twitter at snark_squad. You can find me at My Name is Marines.
I am at Sweeney Says.
And I am at Thoughts on Tomes.
Thank you, as always, to Stefan Chin for the theme music that is playing us out right now. And we will be back in your feed next week. Bye.
Bye.